This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It should give us all encouragement that we can solve climate change. And I think it's important to consider the value of dividing the climate problem into smaller pieces.
The White House has been spewing some pretty foul policy lately. It can be difficult to identify something hopeful about our struggling planet. Maybe the fact that the hole in the ozone layer is actually shrinking. This week on Sea Change Radio, we check in with Derwood Zelke, one of the original crafters of the Montreal Protocol 30 years ago, the key piece of legislation that led to the ozone's current state of healing. Speaking to us from Paris, Zelke relays how the international community views the current state of affairs in the U.S., talks about progress being made around the globe to eliminate pollutants, and details cooperative international efforts to mitigate climate change. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Derwood Zelke. Derwood is the founder and president of the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development, IGSD. Derwood, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to check in with you to update our listeners on some of the work that you and your colleagues at IGSD are engaged in. It's pretty important. And there's been some, with all the terrible news that we hear coming out of the United States in terms of putting its head into the collective sand in terms of acting on climate, the work that you're doing currently and looking back at some of the important work you did surrounding the Montreal Protocol is an important reminder of how things are actually moving in the right direction as a whole in many ways.
Well, I hope so. I mean, our mission is to create the sense of urgent optimism by showing policymakers, and that includes the policymakers who are part of the corporate world, the chieftains of the corporate world, that it is still possible to stay well below 2 degrees by taking immediate actions on three key fronts. We refer to these in a recent paper we did as three different levers you can pull. This paper was done under the chairmanship of Professor Ramanathan at Scripps, University of California, San Diego, Nobel laureate Mario Molina, and myself, and has 30 additional co-authors. These three levers are the following. The first one is the very obvious lever of slamming on the brakes of emissions of CO2 from fossil fuels. And that means moving to clean energy as fast as possible and pursuing energy efficiency to cut the demand down. We're well on our way to this. Renewables are doing remarkably well. We still need to go faster, but that is a very optimistic lever that is working for us. More than half of the new energy from electricity in the U.S., for example, came from renewables last year. And this is the trend around the world. And you see the car companies, including Ford, making a big announcement that they're moving into electric vehicles in a very, very big way. I think they mentioned $11 billion of investment and something more than a dozen new models they'll have by 2020. And that's 2 years away. The second lever is the fast lever. So you think of the first lever of CO2 as one that when you pull it back, it's like stopping a super tanker. You pull it back as hard as you can, but there's a long drift with the CO2 emissions that means you can't get a lot of avoided warming in the near term. So you turn to the second lever, and that's the lever that controls the short-lived climate pollutants. That's black carbon soot. That's methane and tropospheric ozone, the key precursor, and the fluorinated gases, in particular the HFCs that the Montreal Protocol is now taking out of the system, one of the six main greenhouse gases. So when you pull that lever back, you can think of it as stopping a speedboat. you pull the lever back and you get almost instantaneous response in slowing warming. And in fact, you get somewhere between 2 and 6 times more avoided warming at mid-century than you do from the CO2-only lever. So it's very, very important for the this near-term window. You think of it as maybe a 10 to 15-year window. And the reason it's so important is because that window of 10 to 15 years is when the self-reinforcing feedbacks are going to take over the game. Those self-reinforcing feedbacks start with the Arctic sea ice, which we're losing at a very fast rate. And it may be gone entirely within 5 years. Maybe it'll be a little longer. But when that happens, you know, we change the entire climate system and we set off a wicked cascade of other positive feedbacks, starting with the liberation of methane and CO2 from permafrost, and then the die-off of the boreal forest that puts more CO2 in and leaves it vulnerable to lightning strikes and forest fires, which puts more black carbon in. So those feedbacks are going to change the climate game if we don't get the fast mitigation from the short-lived climate pollutants. It's hugely important. Now, black carbon, for example, is the second most powerful climate forcer just behind CO2. And if you were to go to very aggressive efforts to reduce the black carbon, you could cut the rate of global warming in half at mid-century, and you could cut the rate of Arctic warming by two-thirds. So, as I mentioned, Arctic warming is killing the sea ice, and that's leading to this wicked cascade of other self-reinforcing feedback. So the black carbon becomes hugely important to control. It also is a pollutant that kills up to 7 million people a year from air pollution. So there's another huge reason for going after it for the development agenda. If China and India want their cities to be clean and their workers to be healthy and their children to be healthy enough to go to school, they need to get their air pollution under control. And they're mindful of this. They are doing that. So the third lever is learning how to pull CO2 out of the ambient atmosphere after we've emitted it. And we can't make the climate safe again if we don't learn how to do this in a very aggressive way. Now, this starts, fortunately, with a known technology, a brilliant technology called photosynthesis. Use the biological system to pull CO2 out of the atmosphere, put it back into permanent storage in biomass and in the soil. This is not permanent, but it can be long-term storage if you expand your biomass. There are many other strategies as well, including capturing CO2 with a smokestack and turning it into calcium carbonate, as a California corporation called Blue Planet Cement is doing, and then making aggregate and cement, which in this case is highly reflective as well, which means the albedo is high enough to send a lot extra heat back into space. That company is started by Brent Constance. I'm one of the three advisors, along with Leonardo DiCaprio and the guy who's the former head of GSA, the Government Services Administration, under Obama.
We've had Brent Constance on Sea Change Radio, actually.
Okay.
But maybe take a step back, though, and explain a little bit more in detail what black carbon is. It's not something we've really discussed on Sea Change Radio in the past. And right. How are people like yourself working to mitigate it?
Right. So black carbon is that ugly, smelly stuff that comes out of a dirty truck that's in front of you on a steep incline, you know, going over the Grapevine, for example, and spews this plume of black smoke. That's one source of black carbon. The biggest is dirty diesel engines. Another source, and we sometimes think of it as particulate pollution, because it is not a gas, it's not a well-mixed gas, but it is an aerosol, and it settles out much more quickly than a well-mixed gas within a matter of days to weeks. And that's its advantage in terms of speed. It comes from agricultural burning. It comes from brick kilns in the developing world that need to become much, much more efficient. So we have in California, by good hard work, cut the amount of black carbon by about 90%. And that means we've developed the technologies and the institutional structure that we can share with the rest of the world to show them how they can cut their own black carbon quickly. And China and India are mindful of this, and they're starting more aggressive strategies. So, you know, one thing, don't buy your dirty diesels. You know, that's that should be a clear lesson that we've all learned. And the Volkswagen scandal has helped us understand that even better. And then, you know, when you see somebody polluting with a dirty vehicle, you should call the California Air Resources Board, take a picture of their license plate, tell them this is not appropriate. So getting those super polluters off the road is very, very important. Agricultural burning is a little trickier to deal with the agricultural lobby, but there are better strategies, including now things like no-till agriculture that we're developing in a more aggressive way. So we know how to do black carbon reductions, and California is the leader. They can spread that through the California Air Resources Board, through the leadership of Governor Brown, and it can be a feature of his summit that's coming up in September as well.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Durwood Zelke. So Durwood, maybe you can refresh our listeners' memory about the work that you and your colleagues did surrounding the Montreal Protocol, which is now in its 30th anniversary, and how you helped to reduce CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, around the globe.
Yes, the Montreal Protocol is the world's best environmental treaty, and it's also the world's best climate treaty, even though that's not widely appreciated. So if you look at what this effort has done to get rid of the CFCs, the chlorofluorocarbons, and the subsequent alternatives, that includes the HCFCs, and now a third generation called HFCs. If you look at the combined effort that started with citizen boycotts in the US, Europe, and Canada, followed by a few national measures, and then the Montreal Protocol, we have managed to solve an amount of climate change that otherwise would have equaled the amount from CO2 today. And that's about 55% of the entire problem. So it's important to understand that the world actually knows how to solve major parts of climate change by tailoring the specific treaty to the specific pollutants. Now, the most recent effort, it actually started by the Federated States of Micronesia in the Pacific. They said, we are about to go underwater because of sea level rise, and we'd like to find the fastest mitigation we can find. And the Montreal Protocol looks like it could eliminate one of the six main greenhouse gases, the HFCs, hydrofluorocarbons. So they proposed an amendment, and ultimately, in fact, quite quickly, Morocco joined, and Mauritius, and then the United States joined, Europe joined, the Africa group of 54 countries joined. And over a period of several years, the majority of the world said, this is a brilliant idea. Let's get rid of the HFCs using the treaty that we know has already gotten rid of almost 100 similar chemicals by almost 100%. So it's a brilliant treaty that has nearly perfect compliance from every party in the world. It's a member. It's 197 countries. The only treaty that has universal membership. So that wasn't quite good enough, though. There were a few countries that were reluctant, including India, that said, we're not sure that we can do this and find the right substitutes at the right price. The Gulf states were a little reluctant as well. They said, we're extremely hot. How do we know that new alternative refrigerants will work as well in our very, very high ambient temperatures? Pakistan had similar concerns. So working with the Africa group, working with the islands, working with a group of scientists, we were able to help lay the foundation. And I'll go back a step to say that the science became really important. And we helped put a team together led by a Dutch scientist named Huus Velders, selected last year as one of Time Magazine's 100 most important people making a difference in the world. And that team calculated that getting rid of the HFCs could avoid about 100 billion tons of CO2 equivalent. Then a second team led by a Chinese scientist, Yang Yang Yu, and including Velders, calculated that that would equal avoided warming of about 0.5 degrees. So we could get half a degree Celsius of avoided warming from getting rid of this one chemical that we had a treaty that could do the job. So that became another very important piece. Then countries got more and more comfortable as substitutes started coming on the market. Chemical companies made their substitutes. The natural refrigerant industry offered their substitutes. Pretty soon, everybody got comfortable enough that we could go to Kigali last year in 2016, so it's been a little more than a year, and negotiate the final agreement in a five-day period. And it came down to, you know, the 5 days we ran through all Friday night, and then starting Saturday morning at about 7 a.m. on Saturday morning, the party said, we have a deal. And the crowd that was still left of negotiators erupted in cheers and ultimately dancing because they'd worked so hard for several years to get this done. So that means that Kigali Amendment, because it was negotiated in Kigali, Rwanda, is taking out one of the six main greenhouse gases and the warming it would have caused. So it should give us all encouragement that we can solve climate change. And I think it's important to consider the value of dividing the climate problem into smaller pieces. So you've got the HFCs, and that can be done with Montreal. You've got aviation emissions that can be done by the International Civil Aviation Administration, which has passed its own treaty provision in October 2016, the week before Kigali. International Maritime Organization can get rid of black carbon from the shipping industry, where they use something called bunker fuel number 3. They call it black yogurt, and it pollutes a tremendous amount of black carbon. So that hasn't been done with the International Maritime Organization yet, but it should be, and it will be. And so doing this piece-by-piece effort can help strengthen the overall Paris Agreement. Obviously, that's the international agreement that says we should keep warming to well under 2 degrees if we possibly can. And so we can each do a piece of that. And the Montreal Protocol is just, you know, it's heroic. And the parties this year and the 30th anniversary celebrated with a very robust financial replenishment to put in about $550 million for the next 3 years to ensure compliance with the treaty obligations. So that's a vote of confidence by all the parties that they want to continue pursuing climate protection under the treaty that's also, by the way, solved the first great threat to the atmosphere, which is the threat to the stratospheric ozone layer. We have done that as well, and we can measure that we are healing the stratospheric ozone layer.
And there's a recent study out by a publication called the Geophysical Research Letters that revealed that there's been a significant decline in ozone depleting chemicals. They're saying about 20% less ozone depletion just in the last 12 years. Why don't you give us kind of a recap of the ozone layer since you've been involved in it in the early 70s and where we are today, and maybe a glimpse into the future and what it means.
So the Montreal Protocol has put the stratospheric ozone layer on a path to recovery sometime in the 2060, 2065 window. And the new studies that just came out that you mentioned show empirically that we have managed not only to reduce the chemicals, but that we're actually seeing increased ozone as well. This is the good ozone in the stratosphere. So it's the first time that we've had such powerful confirmation. We knew that we were reducing the chemicals, you know, because we can measure that reduction and have since the treaty started 30 years ago. We've also been able to measure the substitutes, that they've gone up the same ratio as the old ones have gone down. But we didn't have that full empirical confirmation that the ozone itself was healing. So this is really welcome news. And for all of us who worked on it for decades, it confirms what we knew was happening. But to be able to say we now can measure it, and you should honor this treaty by making sure you continue to support it and that all the countries of the world continue to meet their obligations and stay in compliance. There are other threats that will come along, and there's one right now from N2O, nitrous oxide, that is a chemical that comes from agriculture primarily. And that is a chemical that's capable and is destroying some of the stratospheric ozone layer. It's also a climate warming gas. So we will have to look at that in the future. Right now, the Montreal Protocol is quite busy digesting its current obligations, but we need to keep an eye on this new threat from N2O, and we're already starting to look at that as well.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Durwood Zelke. He's the founder and president of IGSD, the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development. So, Durwood, you're in Paris right now doing important work to get international organizations and governments around the world to be on the same page in terms of trying to fight climate change and pollution. What does it mean that you are based in Washington, D.C. in today's toxic environment there? Maybe give us a kind of a sneak peek into the way the rest of the world is viewing our now renegade government.
Well, when President Macron said, "Let's make our planet great again," and invited U.S. scientists and climate activists to come to Paris, IGSD was the first one to say, "We will be there." And the president sent his communications team over to our new office immediately. They filmed an interview with me and my director of the Paris office, a very talented French lawyer named Maxime Beaugrand. And the president put that interview on his Facebook page for the Elysee, their White House, and also tweeted it. So we, if anyone would like, they can go take a look at that. We're very happy to be able to have a foothold in a country like France with a president who not only believes in the threat of climate change, but who's willing to be a leader on it. And he had his own summit at the end of last year, December 12th, to rally the troops to implement the Paris Agreement. And he has come up with a whole series of strategies, including the focus on fast mitigation. Now, we still have tremendous amount of work to do in the United States, try to hold on to the gains we've made over the many, many decades of bipartisan support for not only climate, but for all environmental protection. And again, the challenge in the case of Montreal Protocol is to work with the industry players, because we have about 500,000 jobs in the industry sectors that are involved in the HFCs under the Kigali Amendment, and they are eager to be part of the trillion-dollar market for the next decade. And this is something that the Trump administration is and should remain sensitive to, as they already have helped Carrier in the very early days of the Trump administration keep some of their jobs in the United States. So we're trying to find the best way to work under a very difficult set of circumstances. And there's nothing I could say that would add to to an explanation of the chaos of this administration. It's everyone in this country knows that, and so does most of the world. And what I worry about most is ceding leadership on an issue that's vital to our own national security. And we have generals and admirals who are arguing to the White House, you should consider climate change as a national security risk, where we are going to have these cascading feedback mechanisms. We're going to have more of the same thing that we just saw in Montecito in Santa Barbara, California, what we saw with Harvey and Irma and Irene and all the different hurricanes we had this year. This is going to be this is the beginning, and it's going to cause huge refugee flows. It's going to cause famine and shortages of drinking water. I mean, this kind of climate chaos is very threatening to national security. So we have a very, very strong interest in helping the world stay stable with its climate, so that we keep people settled in their own countries and let them pursue their own prosperity. So we are hoping that the national security apparatus will understand this, as they have over many administrations, and that they will convince the Trump team that they should pay attention to that aspect, among others.
Well, in the face of this vacuum of leadership, it's very encouraging to know that there are leaders like yourself out there doing important work. Durwood Zelke, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by the Blind Boys of Alabama, Dr. John, and Shuggie Otis. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.